Welcome to the Jeffers Brief, only on Contra Radio Network.
And hello again, I'm John Jeffers here at the Jeffers Brief, your host, founder, and executive producer here at the Contra Radio Network. We are also on KYAH 540 AM out of Delta, Utah. Welcome, Memorial Day weekend. Remember those that have fallen. To defend your right, how about this? To defend your rights, whether you agree with someone else's or not, you still have the right to the 10 rights, the 10 amendments on the Constitution. But anyways, I want to say welcome. I'm glad you're all here. Another thrilling episode. It is. It's another thrilling episode. It truly is. It truly is. All right. One of the things, before we get started, look, what do I want to do here? You know what? Sometimes I don't always get it right. I know. And lately, I've been doing kind of something backwards, and I want to take care of it now. And basically what I want to do is this. You know, we have listeners, not just here in the United States, which is, you know, we do. That's the majority of our listeners. But we have listeners that all over the planet, really. And I just wanted to take a chance. I just wanted to mention you. So, you know, we have our brothers and sisters in Canada. Now, I've mentioned it briefly. I'm going to have probably next month, we're going to explore what our brothers and sisters in Canada are going through. And it's not good. And the mainstream media is not going to tell you about it. They're not even going to cover the story, but we are. But I want to say, you know, a few listeners in Australia, New Zealand. God bless you people in New Zealand. You stuck to your guns, literally. You didn't turn them in because of a typical government knee-jerk reaction to a bad incident that law-abiding citizens had nothing to do with. So let's punish them, right? Our listeners in Ireland, by the way, hello goes out to Porky Wheel in Northern Ireland. You know who you are. Spain, France. Yeah, France. And they're still fighting it. Now, I have a lot of issues with the people in France. Not everybody, because not everybody voted for Macron. But let's be honest about it. Macron didn't hide who he was or what he was going to do. And the majority of the French people decided, you know what, we like this idea. And they shunned Marie Le Pen, who I thought was a good candidate, but what do I know? I'm not French. I'm not living there. But now they don't know what to do. The government doesn't know what to do about the yellow vest. In the United Kingdom, the UK, you people have my sympathies. And I know some of you are fighting to get back what's yours. Instead of letting the government just let everybody in and, you know, you want to see what multiculturalism does to a country? Look at France, look at the UK, look at Germany, look at Norway, look at Sweden. And believe it or not, we have one listener from Greece. Welcome. Welcome, I say. Anyway, I wanted to get that out of the way. Now, somebody's saying, well, John, in the United States, what state has the most listeners? Well, I got to tell you, it changes from month to month. This month, so far, it looks like Massachusetts. Now, look, when I say Massachusetts, a lot of you are thinking, oh, God, what a liberal state. Hey, look, only the eastern half is liberal. The western half is not. Then we got Virginia, Old Dominion. And believe it or not, we actually got listeners in New York. And of course, in my state, the tyranny state of Illinois, which is just bananas. And of course, you know what? For the first time, we got Utah. Utah is in on it. It's true. It's true. Utah's in the top five for downloads. We got Washington State, California. Now, California is the opposite of Massachusetts. It's all liberal on the West Coast. But you get into Eastern California, they're all conservative. They're just outvoted and outnumbered constantly. And, of course, we got the Lone Star State of Texas. Now, if you've never been to Texas, let me tell you something. This is what I like about Texas. And when you get there, they got the Lone Star everywhere. See, in my mind, I think Texas believes it's still its own republic, and in some ways it truly is. We have Ohio, Colorado, what? That's a new one on our list. And of course, we have listeners in Indiana and Arizona. By the way, Arizona, also known as Free USA, Wisconsin, the Cheddar Curtain, get behind there, Michigan, Minnesota, North Carolina. Speaking of North Carolina, I want you all to pay attention to it here. We've got a new show here on Contra Radio Network for podcasting. Mm-hmm. It's called The Dope Farm. You're saying, Dope Farm? What does that mean? Dope is an acronym, and it stands for Data on Proceeding Engagement. That's run by, and the host is Wynn Parkinson, good North Carolina farmer. He was in the Army. He was a paratrooper. Got good stuff going. Georgia, Florida, and believe it or not, we got Pennsylvania. We're seeing stuff, states pop up that didn't pop up before. Maine, Kentucky, Missouri, South Carolina, Oklahoma, Maryland, Iowa, Arkansas. Don't get too many out of Arkansas. We got Delaware. Not a lot of Delaware, not a lot of Kansas. Mississippi, Nebraska. Our good friend, he knows who he is, out there in Omaha. Oregon, which is a home of our friend Jeff Reynolds, author. If you want to check out his book, I would suggest it. Tennessee, Vermont. Mm-hmm. So I'm just telling you, these are all where our listeners are. And the reason I'm telling you this is I want you to know that we need sponsors. Looking for a commercial sponsor for the show. Get a hold of me, ContraRadio@Live.com, ContraRadio@Live.com. Get a hold of me if you're interested in sponsoring a show here on CRN. And if you're looking, you want to get on KYAH, you got Prepping 2.0, my show, The Jeffers Brief, and The Conservative Underground with Don Lowry. Those three shows we air on KYAH. So if you're looking for that, let me know. I just wanted to put it out there. This is what we've got. Something I want to... You've heard of Candace Owens, yes? Love Candace Owens. And let's talk a little bit about Candace Owens. Will Chamberlain wrote this in Human Events. And it's kind of interesting. And I wanted to share it with you. Because Candace Owens, she is a gift to the conservative movement. A gift. And she should be treasured as a gift. Breitbart's Alan Bukhari reports that Facebook has a hate agents list, which includes Candace Owens. This helps explain why Owens was briefly suspended from Facebook last Friday for a post arguing liberal supremacy is more of a threat than white supremacy. She included a screenshot of one of her tweets suggesting absent fathers are a bigger contributor to poverty among African Americans than white people. Now, according to a statement given to Bukhari, Facebook claims it, quote-unquote, mistakenly applied a temporary block, to Owens' account, and affirmed that, quote, she was not one of those people. Really? Those people? Recently banned from Facebook for violating their policies. Oh, you mean the community standards, which have no rhyme, reason, or consistency among them? You mean those standards? Fools. It's true. They're just They're just, no one's buying it anymore. You know, one of my listeners sent me a message. And he said, you know, all they do is they change the algorithm. And then when Congress goes looking into it, they change the algorithm back again. See, we don't know what happened. It was a mistake. And all it takes is a push of a button. I mean, they think they're slick and no one knows what they're doing. But we know. The question is, what are we going to do about it? Now, this statement should not reassure conservatives. The revelation that Facebook has a hate agents list and is monitoring conservative accounts, waiting for a pretext to ban them, is chilling. It demonstrates the urgency of protecting platform access as a civil right. But for Owens, it's a part of a pattern. Despite her nominally, unquote, oppressed identity as a black woman, she is treated in appalling fashion by the left. For example, when she spoke at the University of Pennsylvania last month, mostly white protesters screamed epithets and harassed her. This was not the first time she was confronted by a rabid mob of mostly white leftists. Last August in Philadelphia, Owens and Charlie Kirk were attacked by a mob outside a restaurant. Now, many conservatives point out the obvious double standard. Candace Owens is treated in a way that no liberal, black or white, would ever be treated. But just pointing out the double standard doesn't fully capture the texture of Owens' interactions with Facebook and with the left more generally. Another analytic lens is more appropriate. It's called intersectionality. Now, this is a concept that shall not be named. Conservatives have a reflexive disgust when someone brings up intersectionality. Ben Shapiro's description of the concept from his latest book, The Right Side of History, is par for the course. He says Professor Kimberly Crenshaw of Columbia University came up with a term to describe this coalition of victims, intersectionality. According to Crenshaw, human beings are members of various groups, racial groups, gender groups, religious groups, sexual orientation groups, etc., etc., etc. And we can describe their lived realities by referring to the intersection between these groups. Thus, a black female lesbian Muslim has a different lived reality than a white male heterosexual Christian. Furthermore, we can identify the level of difficulty someone has experienced in life simply by referencing the various groups of which she is a member. The more minority groups to which you are a member, the more you have been victimized, the more your opinion about the innate institutional bigotry of the United States ought to carry weight. Now, Shapiro's characterization of Professor Crenshaw's argument isn't close to fair. Crenshaw has not, to my knowledge, made any claims about the level of difficulty in someone's life being inexorably tied to the number of oppressed groups they are a member of. Nor has she argued that the more groups one is a member of, the more weight their opinion carries. To understand intersectionality, it's best to let Crenshaw speak. So here's a primer on it. So in 1989, a young law professor, Crenshaw, published what became a seminal paper in the social services. The catalyst was a failed class action lawsuit, DeGraffenreid versus General Motors. In the 1976 case, the plaintiffs had alleged that the car company was discriminating against black women, as Crenshaw explained in a recent op-ed. She writes, "The black jobs were men's jobs, and women's jobs were only for whites. Thus, while a black applicant might get hired to work on the floor of the factory if he were male, if she were a black female, she would not be considered. Similarly, a woman might be hired as a secretary if she were white, but wouldn't have a chance at the job if she were black." So despite this clear discrimination, the trial court threw out the case, refusing to allow plaintiffs to combine their racial discrimination claims with their sex discrimination claims. Crenshaw notes rightly that was a big miss in the law. She explained in her op-ed how this led her to coin the term intersectionality. Now, intersectionality was my attempt to make feminism, anti-racist activism, and anti-discrimination law do what I thought they should, highlight the multiple avenues through which racial and gender oppression were experienced so that the problems would be easier to discuss and understand. I know, just bear with me, guys. I know we're talking about Candace Owens, but this is the background you got to understand here, okay? So intersectionality is an analytic sensibility, a way of thinking about identity and its relationship to power, she says. Now, Crenshaw's point is simple. The experience of a black woman is not simply the combination of the experience of a black man and the experience of a white woman. It is distinct social phenomena that must be analyzed independently to be properly explained. In other words, I'm going to look at it and I'm going to tell you what it means. And the intersectional method, one that avoids smashing different groups' experiences together to explain the experience at the intersection, can be used throughout social science. As Crenshaw explained in her seminal paper, Professor Crenshaw is not arguing that the multiply burdened are necessarily more important or wise. She simply demanded that her academic colleagues analyze race, gender, and other axes of, you know, oppression in a more nuanced way by avoiding myopic focus on a single categorical axis of privilege. Primer over, let's return to Owens. Candace Owens is a black woman, yet she is censored, treated with contempt, and subject to the hatred and vitriol that few other people in America deal with. Indeed, almost no other black woman would be treated the way Owens is anywhere in America. So what's going on here? Again, most conservatives would point out the double standard and leave it there. But what if we analyzed Owens' experience through the lens of intersectionality? And all that requires is that we take a comprehensive look at Candace's lived experience and, borrowing from Crenshaw, understand how identities and power work together from one context to another. So in 2019, political affiliation is, to paraphrase Crenshaw, an axis of privilege. Democrats own the social media platforms and dominate the mainstream media, academia, and the bureaucracy. They are privileged. Conservatives are on the fringes in all these areas. They are decidedly not privileged. Progressives can spread unhinged conspiracy theories about the president being a Russian agent, no one blinks. But if a conservative suggests that something might be off about biological males competing with women in weightlifting competitions, they will be banned from social media. It's true, it's happened. You know it, we've all heard it. So, back to it. If Owens were a white conservative male, she would probably be disliked, but not hated. There are plenty of conservative white men out there. Even if they have it tough sometimes, it's normally enough not to generate the same level of vitriol from the left. If she were a liberal black woman, she would be a valued advocate. But because she is a conservative black woman, she is loathed by the left. And her experience is not just a combination of her black, female, and conservative identities. It is the distinct social phenomena at the intersection of those identities. This phenomena that manifests itself in the way Owens is treated. It's why Facebook put her on the hate agents list. It's why white leftists scream racial epithets at her while opposing white supremacy. It's why the left wants her gone. Now, Professor Crenshaw would probably object to this analysis, but that's the thing about that idea. Once it is let free into the world, the creator doesn't get to control how others appropriate it. In a world where conservatives are silenced on social media and have no meaningful presence in the mainstream media or academia, how is it wrong to say that progressives are privileged? And isn't every double standard that benefits progressive just a manifestation of unexamined progressive privilege? Think about it. Jussie Smollett, he is black and gay. In the standard myopic intersectional analysis, he would be oppressed. And yet he walked away scot-free from his ridiculous hate crime hoax, getting an indictment with 16 felony charges dropped. Where in the hell does that happen? Nowhere, except in Chicago and Kim Fox's state's attorney's office, but that's being dealt with, we hope. Now, the intersectional lens here is revealing. Smollett may be black and gay, but he is wealthy and liberal too, and in Chicago, the unearned privilege he possesses as a result of his wealthy and liberal identities overwhelm whatever oppression he might suffer as a result of his black gay identities. Indeed, as Crenshaw might remind Smollett, acknowledging privilege is hard, particularly for those who experience discrimination and exclusion. So the end goal is this. One might argue that appropriating progressive concepts is a bad idea because doing so reaffirms their framework. Not so. The weakness of left-wing intersectional analysis is myopia. It sees membership in the specific oppressed groups as always and everywhere a disadvantage and fails to account for how progressivism itself might be a privileged identity. The right could take intersectionality, apply it to a more expansive and nuanced way, and show how the left's own analytic framework undermines its political project. This doesn't require the right to embrace a victim mindset. Far from it. Remember, Gens Crenshaw explains, intersectionality is an analytic sensibility. It's not an identity. You can choose, like Owens, to be a victor and to overcome the obstacles placed in your way. At the same time, you can take your adversary's concepts and use them to blow up their entire philosophy. So when privileged, wealthy, white, liberal Facebook engineers place Candace Owens on a hate agents list, it's not just a double standard. Racial, cultural, and political privilege are all at work. It's the time the right made Facebook's gleeful censors check their privilege. That was Will Chamberlain. It's true. All right. So many things to do, so little time. John Solomon over at The Hill. Yes, I'm not letting this go. You know how I feel about this. Listen to my last four episodes. I'm not letting this go, and I will continue to bang the drum. And if I have to go on the mountaintop and shout it, I will do so alone, if necessary, but I don't think I do. Speaking of being alone, I want you all to understand something here. Just because you're a prepper, just because you're a patriot, you are not alone. There are more of us out here. Maybe we're just more silent about it. Maybe we can't go march in the streets because we have freaking jobs. And we don't rely on the government to put food in my refrigerator year after year after year, becoming a generational thing. No. Mark Meadows is John Solomon's primary source. Now, during the interview, this I'm going to play for you. Mark Meadows discusses transcripts and recordings of George Papadopoulos, which are part of the Spygate operation. And these transcripts were first revealed by Congressman Trey Gowdy yesterday. So listen to this.
If the Bureau is going to send an informant in, the informant is going to be wired. And if the Bureau is monitoring telephone calls, there's going to be a transcript of that. But they haven't been made public, and I think one in particular is going, it has the potential to actually persuade people. There is some information in these transcripts that I think has the potential to be a game changer if it's ever made public.
Possibly even get Democrats to pay attention, and maybe it has something to do with George Papadopoulos. Former Oversight Chair Trey Gowdy claimed the FBI withheld potential game changer evidence from the FISA court during the Russia probe. What could that be? Let's ask someone who might just know. He is on the House Oversight Committee, GOP member, Congressman Mark Meadows. Congressman, I'm sure you saw that. You know Trey Gowdy. What does he mean?
Well, he's a real serious chairman and actually has seen some documents that actually I have not seen, but we have come to the same conclusion, and that is indeed George Papadopoulos was actually taped and recorded, and those interviews, actually there are records of those. And I think what happens is in my conversations with Mr. Papadopoulos and others, when that comes out, when the president declassifies that, I think the American people will be astonished to see that not only was it going on, and the president was right that he was actually taped and recorded, but other than that is he was not colluding with the Russians, and they knew this very early on. And so that could be the game changer that Trey is referring to.
Right, but they just destroyed his life and put him in jail for 12 days, but that's no big deal. It's only George Papadopoulos, right? It's only a person, an American citizen. Now, I'm just wondering, Ambassador Downer happens to meet him in a bar. Could he possibly have been wearing a wire? Joseph Mifsud's got Russian ties. Does he really have Russian ties? Because the Mueller report says he does. But there's no proof he does. The guy's from Malta, living in London.
Well, I mean, when you look at the narrative that is out there, there's a whole lot of suggestions that the professor, as we call him, had Western intelligence ties. That's supported in a number of other areas, especially from his Italian connections. Additionally, when we start to look at this, it's not just with Mr. Downer and the professor, but it's also a lot of the operation that went on even after that. So before July 31st of 2016, when the investigation opened, we know that there were some improper activities going on, and after certainly there were, and I believe that Attorney General Barr is very serious to getting to the bottom of it.
Last 10 seconds. The president's just got to declassify it and let it go out there. Do you think the delay is almost over?
I think the delay's over. I think the president is serious. I've spoken to him recently, and I think declassification is right around the corner, and hopefully the American people will be able to judge for themselves.
Comey and Brennan are already turning on each other, as well as James Baker is trying to cover his own tracks. This thing is changing quickly. Congressman, thanks so much.
Well, there you have it. I just wanted to put it out there, guys. I've been educating you on this whole mess. The problem is this. The scope is so large, and there's so many moving parts. Sometimes it's very difficult to actually try to keep up on it, but that's what I'm trying to do. Because there are people out there that are buying in to the leftist and Democratic narrative, saying, you know, this whole idea that, you know, they get a do-over on the special investigation. No, you don't. 2 years, $30 million. It's okay. Let them go. That reminds me, the Twisted Sisters, Tlaib and Omar, everybody says, impeach them, get them off there. No, do not get them off there. Let them, they should set up an open mic and let these two Twisted Sisters just blather on and on about their anti-Semitic views and everything else that comes out of their mouth. They do more for the GOP because it's coming. People aren't buying into this nonsense. Sure, there's a handful of true believers that believe it, but the majority don't. As a matter of fact, I think a majority of the Democrats, even though they don't have the spine to tell them to sit down and shut up, and I'm glad they don't, would love to do that, but they don't have the spine to do it. They're afraid. And also, this whole idea about, you know, we're going to impeach the president. So what? Impeach him. Good luck getting it through the Senate. It will never happen. They will not convict. Now, we're talking about, you know how much I love Antifa, right? I get perverse joy in watching them being forced to take asphalt naps. I do. Whenever I find a video of Antifa getting their little beta butts kicked, and hard and privately so, and publicly so, I post it. I love it. It gives me perverse joy. I found this on CNS News, and I didn't know this, because naturally, it's never ever being put out there. But a judge has ordered an Antifa activist to pay $22,000 in legal fees to Conservative Judicial Watch. Michael Chapman at CNS News is reporting this. This is great. I love it. Like I said, I can't stand Antifa. I think they're cowards. And I think they're a bunch of, you know, they try to come across as, you know, we're poor, we're oppressed, and we're trying to fight the man. Most of Antifa comes from middle-income families, you know, trophy participation families, where mommy and daddy have told their kids, you're so special, you're so smart. Well, got news for you. They might be special and smart to you, mom and dad. To the rest of us, they're just like any other kid. Only this time, you kept feeding it and feeding it and feeding it, and instead of sitting there and giving them a crack across the backside on occasion to get them to fly right, you just kept feeding into it, and now you get this. But anyways, in a case in which he described Antifa activist Yvette Filarco's legal claims entirely frivolous, California District Judge Vince Chabria recently ordered her to pay $22,000 in legal fees incurred by Judicial Watch and the $4,000 in litigation cost. Filarca, a middle school teacher in the Berkeley Unified School District, and two co-plaintiffs had sued the Berkeley Unified School District to try to prevent it from turning over to Judicial Watch their communications mentioning Filarca, Antifa, and By Any Means Necessary. As Judicial Watch stated in a May 21st press release, Filarca is a prominent member of By Any Means Necessary a radical leftist group that was founded by the Marxist Revolutionary Workers League that protests conservative speaking engagements. Now, this is a huge victory for Judicial Watch against Antifa and the violent left, said Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton. Ms. Falarca attacked Judicial Watch without basis, and the court was right to reject her ploy to deny our right to know because we don't share her violent left views. So in 2017, Judicial Watch filed a California Public Records Act request seeking public records information about Falarca's Antifa activism and its effect within the Berkeley Unified School District, stated the legal group. In her lawsuit aimed at keeping the Berkeley School District from furnishing the records, Falarca alleged that Judicial Watch was misusing the law for political means and the district should refuse to provide the information. Despite Falarca's claims, the judge said Judicial Watch is entitled to attorney's fees because the plaintiff's lawsuit was frivolous and their litigation conduct was unreasonable. The plaintiffs had no reasonable argument to protect those documents from disclosure, stated Judge Chabria. Falarca has a history of radical left activism. In January, she was ordered to stand trial in Sacramento, California, because of an alleged assault that occurred at a demonstration in 2016. So let me see here. I'm not using the new math. Let me see. Let's add 22 and 4. That's 26,000. Yes, I love it. I love it. I just can't. It makes me laugh. It's true. It makes me giggle. It's true. You guys heard of Alan West? Love Colonel West. He did a commentary on CNS News. And his commentary is entitled, "Socialism is Philosophy of Control Freaks." It is. There's no way you can not see it. I mean, let's face it. All socialists want to do is control your life and mine. Now, for some reason, people that like socialism think that somewhere down the line, they are going to be put in charge of everyone else. They're going to be given, you know, a title and a position of authority and control over others. Guess what? Ain't happening. It isn't. Some will. The majority of you will be lumped into with the rest of us, believe me. But Lieutenant Colonel West, I really like him. He's not afraid to say what's on his mind, and I can dig that. And you should, too. Well, you should. And in this commentary, he speaks his mind. He says, "Socialism is the philosophy of failure, the creed of ignorance, and the gospel of envy. Perth, Scotland, 28 May 1948. Churchill and the Europe Unite speeches, 1947 and 1948. The inherent vice of capitalism is the unequal sharing of blessings. The inherent virtue of socialism is the equal sharing of miseries. House of Commons, 22 October 1945. Above are two respective quotes of Sir Winston Churchill regarding that collectivist economic model of Karl Marx and Frederick Engels we call socialism. So just last week, Fox Business News focused their discussions and held a town hall meeting about capitalism and socialism. I would have preferred their using the term free market or free enterprise, but hey, it's all semantics at that point. However, the progressive socialist left has done a brilliant job denigrating the term capitalism. What they are directing their angst against is crony capitalism, the use of government policies to favor certain special interests in respective industries. Now, it's not very often we hear individuals explain how it was President Jimmy Carter's 1977 Community Reinvestment Act that set the conditions for the 2008 mortgage-related financial crisis. What we do hear all too often is that the big banks were bailed out. I'll be the first to say that using taxpayers' resources to bail out a private sector organization is a violation of free market economics. However, We must also agree that the government leveraging its power, will, and might to create false rights is an equally bad policy. So last week, as I listened to the proponents of socialism and read that our younger generation seemed to prefer this economic system, I pondered, how best do we describe socialism? And during my Sunday morning 5-mile run, it hit me. Socialism is the philosophy of the control freaks. Think about it now. Everything about the socialist rhetoric is about controlling some aspect of your life. It's about disavowing you as an individual and making you part of a collective will. If there is anything abjectly anti-American, it is socialism, being that our constitutional republic focuses on the individual's sovereignty, not the intrusive nature of the institutional government. Yet, the latter is exactly what these progressive socialists are offering. But boy, howdy, does it sound good. Consider this. Just last week, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, what a goof he is. We're going to ban hot dogs in the city. Well, la-dee-da. Became the 23rd Democratic Party candidate for president. In his announcement video, he stated, "There's plenty of money in this world. There's plenty of money in this country. It's just in the wrong hands." Wrong hands? One must ask. Who is Mayor de Blasio to make such a disconcerting statement? It's simple. He is representative of the socialist control freaks who believe that, based upon their ideological agenda, they have a right to control our wealth and our resources. That is the first tenet of a socialist economic model, wealth redistribution. You guys know this. You guys have heard this. It was French economist Frederick Bastiat who said in his essay, The Law, referred to de Blasio's insidious idea as legal plunder. It is the government-sanctioned theft which is based on leftist greed and misplaced sense of philanthropy. We are constantly bombarded with the notion that health care is a right. Why, of course, it is to socialists, because it is all about controlling your body, your ability to make decisions about the most personal issue, your health care. Free health care, Medicare for all, sounds so very enticing, but in the end, we the people are ceding over our personal decision, our freedom, to the institution of government to control and decide how care is distributed. I guess that there are those who do not believe such. Then again, take the United Kingdom's national health care system, the NHS. This socialized medical system works so well that Mick Jagger decided, because he can afford to have his heart surgery done in the New York City. Smart man. The delays in providing timely health care in England are well known, and here in America, we have this Obamacare-created bureaucracy called the Independent Payment Advisory Board. Unelected bureaucrats, not responsible to our Congress, who make health care pricing decisions. In other words, who gets what procedure and who does not, as well as reimbursement rates for medical professionals. Yeah, they get to control health care in America. They decide the meaning of life, who gets to live. The current debate about killing unborn and born babies reflect that notion as well. They control who and when you die. The leftist socialists in America want to control what you eat and drink. Y'all know about the soda taxes, right? There you go. And it's always masked behind the oh-so-emotional notion of caring for you. No. It's about controlling your life and your lifestyle because, well, you are too ignorant, too dumb to do so yourself. Remember, the socialists must tell you what to eat and drink because that will reduce healthcare expenditures. Imagine, if you will, I were keen for a day and mandated by edict that all Americans had to wake up and run 3 miles a day, or else. Oh yeah, that basically happened under the Obama administration. Buy health insurance or be taxed. That, folks, is what control freaks in our government do. It's called behavior modification by way of taxation, an individual mandate. The left wants to control what you drive, too. You know, after all, we are causing this man-made climate change. I do not want an electric vehicle. I like my Jeep Wrangler Rubicon, my Toyota Tacoma, and my Victory cross-country 8-ball motorcycle. Heck, the socialists in America, as in California, are even telling us controlling what type of house folks could have. And we all know that our little version of Evita Perón, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, wants any building not in compliance with her ideas to be refitted. I am still trying to figure out that train to Hawaii, since you will be controlling our means of mass transportation also. So let's be honest here. Why do young people embrace the philosophy of control freaks? I thought that young people did not want to be told what to do. There is a very distinct difference from classic liberals, constitutional conservatives, and these progressive socialists. Classic liberals believe in individual rights, freedoms, and liberties. You know, those words from our Declaration of Independence. This new American socialism is rooted in ideological rights, a right to own a home, health care, murder unborn babies, climate change, same-sex marriage, the right to other people's resources. The socialist control freaks do not embrace our constitutional right. As a matter of fact, they see the right to keep and bear arms, our Second Amendment right, as an obstacle. Case in point, see Venezuela. So we'll close with this quote attributed to Vladimir Lenin. The goal of socialism is communism. Socialism is an economic model that leads to a societal model that does one thing, controls the populace and turns its citizens into subjects. What type of person would want that? Only the control freaks. And he's right. They want to control everything about you. They want to control everything you say and do. What do we got here? Okay. Let's talk about a movement of conspiracy theories. Yes, I'm bashing on the left today. More so than, you know, I normally would. But they've earned it, so we shall, of course, go with it. Daniel Greenfield. Beautiful commentary, and I want to share it with you. Every movement has a mission statement. Make America Great is the conservative one. It's the again part that makes it conservative. The enemies of making America great have one too. If the radicals had red hats, they would say they're out to get you. They're out to get you has been the leftist motto since before Marx learned to shave and then decided to stop doing it. The arc of history may bend toward many places, but the black rainbow serviced by a snarling leprechaun with a PhD and a cocaine problem always begins and ends in the same paranoid place. They're destroying the planet. They're hoarding all the wealth. They start all the wars. They're dividing the country. They're killing kids in schools. They're conspiring with Russians. They killed JFK. Did I miss something? I'm sure I did. Anyways. The Democrats crave inspirational leaders for the same reason that alcoholics need mouthwash. It covers up the ugly stench. Lefties love packaging their hateful ravings, paranoid delusions, and plans for world domination with moving soliloquies about everyone coming together to make a difference. It's the kumbaya moment! So far, coming together and making a difference has killed approximately 200 million people. Between Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot, and Jim Jones, more people have been killed by lefties coming together and making a difference than by the AIDS and the Ebola virus combined. Every day, the media warns about the threat of unvaccinated children in schools spreading measles. There are far more American children infected with the diseases that piled up skulls in Cambodia and filled the Russian tundra with mass graves, that starved Chinese peasants to death and served poison Kool-Aid to American children. Schools spread the infection like wildfire, and the only vaccine against it isn't allowed on school grounds. So what killed all those people is a mental bacillus that can be examined under a microscope. It has cilia, no spine, and whispered its sour nothings in the ears of commissars and soldiers, of peasants and workers, of brother number three and 1,000 frenzied school children beating their teachers to death. The thing it whispered in their ears was, they're out to get you. They're out to get you. Normal people do not murder their neighbors for wearing glasses. They do not sink them in boats weighed down with stones. They do not inform on their parents or poison their own children. But it can be convinced to do these things once they've come together to, you know, make a difference. Why do lefties keep coming together to make a difference? Because they're fighting an unjust society. And what makes a society unjust and in need of fighting with protests, bombs, and gulags? They're out to get you. They're out to get you. All leftist credos begin with the conviction of a powerful conspiracy against the groups of people they hope to recruit. A conspiracy that is implausible as it is unsustainable, which can only end in genocide or social transformation. Somehow, the left usually manages to fit both into its busy schedule. First, it was class. The capitalist pigs, the factory owners, like the Ingalls family, were maintaining a permanent underclass while reaping all the profits. Mankind was doomed to live in a Dixonian novel of starving orphans, cowering beneath puffing smokestacks, unless the proletariat rose up in revolution. Then, it was going to be a racial war. And now, finally, the capitalists are plotting to destroy the planet. Not like any good conspiracy theory, the they keep changing. So does the you. So one day, it's the evil factory owners keeping the working class down. The next day, it's the racist working class whites keeping black people down. And then it's the homophobic blacks keeping gay people down. And then it's the Islamophobic gays keeping Muslims down. Finally, it's everyone destroying the planet by driving cars without buying carbon credits from Al Gore. Intersectionality means that everyone is a you and a they. Everyone has a cause to hate and fear and to be hated and feared. There is no such thing as being too paranoid about identity politics. And in identity politics, the only question is, are you paranoid enough? As with all these murderous ideologies, the conspiracy theories began with conscious actions and end with subconscious crimes. A list of specific charges concludes with one unforgivable offense, existence. The final verdict is death. What sort of monsters go around killing millions? The same sort of little monsters who shout down professors, assault speakers, and expect an imminent apocalypse if they don't get their way. Victims! To believe that they are out to get you, you need to be a victim! To be a victim isn't to experience suffering or to survive a horrifying act of violence. It is to be convinced that the world is an unfair place, and it can only be made unfair when those responsible are put down, or as they call it, social justice. Every genocide begins with a conspiracy theory. So does victimhood. The conspiracy theory claims that utopia would be possible, but the bad people insist on selfishly ruining it for everyone. In Rwanda, the bad people were the Tutsis. In Nazi Germany, they were the Jews. In America, they're everyone. Racism has its limits. Applying enough DNA tests, there's someone a racist won't kill. But when everyone is complicit in the intersectional crimes of everyone else and the destruction of the planet, who is really innocent? Killings in leftist societies don't stop when they run out of people to kill. They only end when the machine runs out of executions to shoot, beat, torture, mutilate them. And human nature, being what it is, and both evil and goodness, they eventually do. There comes a point when killing people no longer makes anyone feel good, and that's when the People's Republic of Killingstan settles down to a steady decline into corruption and decay, like an old gangster passing away his remaining years in a drunken haze to make the time go by more quickly. Well, what do you think so far? Yeah? Their message, the one that gets neighbors to smash each other's heads and sons to turn on their fathers. It is broadcast on every channel and taught in every school. It's hummed in songs and made into movies. They're out to get you. They're out to get you. The conspiracy is all the more compelling for being nebulous, shapeless, and formless. The villains are oil companies and the working class. At any moment, the progressive male college student can become a rapist. Bigotry is in our subconscious. Carbon exhaled in every breath. The enemy is everywhere. The sky is falling. Once upon a time, the conspiracies were simple. Now we live in a world haunted by our own demons. The crime was never truly capitalism or bigotry. It was human nature. And human nature is also the motive. They're out to get you, is the primal paranoid idea of politics. It taps into the part of our brain that ran from wolves or killed them. The wolves that become men, and sometimes we are them. Leftist politics is just another means of justifying the robbery and abuse of your neighbors. It's the sense of oppression is just entitlement misspelled. Its targets are guilty because the perpetrators are greedy. Cain was the first communist. He killed Abel because he worked harder and believed in God. When God tried to tell the first murderer that the evil was not in his brother, it was in him, he didn't listen. Modern lefties refuse to listen to the central message of religion, that we fix the world by fixing ourselves, rather than fixing ourselves by remaking the world in our own broken image. The mark of Cain is a red flag. Where you see it, socialism and spilled blood soon follow. A layer cake of academic theories and violent outrage are used as masks for the same old evils of envy and hate. And so millions of leftists are coming together to make a difference in America by rioting, punching, deplatforming, firing, harassing, suppressing, spying on their political opponents, murdering babies, and reminding us that they're a deadlier outbreak than any disease hit this country in a century. The cries of justice really mean power, and the cries of change really mean murder. Utopia won't build itself. Will it? Of course not. And he's right on. He's right on. Sometimes I just don't know where I'm going with it. Let's see, how much time have I got here? Have I got time to fit this? Oh, I do. I'm firing away at this. Now, I know of those that live, that are listening to KYAH, a lot of you are farmers in Utah. Some of you are listening to this podcast on crn.podbean.com, and you're on your tractors, and you're working the fields. This is the busy time of the year. I get it. But this is interesting. I want to get it to you. It's by Christopher Whalen, the American conservative. China has already lost the trade war. You hear me? China has already lost a trade war. They just don't even know it. So here we go. President Donald Trump, Chinese President Xi Jinping, are caught in a growing dispute over trade and more broadly the significant differences between their two very different political economies. Tough as it is to predict the future, there are some signs as to who will be the winners and losers. Trump calls the dispute a little squabble, and in economic terms, the threat of conflict with China does seem minimal. The retaliatory tariffs China unveiled last week, for example, won't significantly slow the American economy, cutting economic growth by about a tenth of a percentage point next year if the spat isn't ended, according to the Oxford Economics and Moody's Analytics. Indeed, the biggest cost may be imposed on investors who for years have inflated the economic potential of communist China's state-directed economy, which is true. Major public companies in the United States, including Apple, Caterpillar, and Boeing, are among some of the leading exporters to China. Yet exports to China account for just 7.2% of overall American exports in 2018. According to the U.S. Trade Representatives, the top export categories that year were aircraft, $18 billion, machinery, $14 billion, electrical machinery, $13 billion, optical and medical instruments, $9.8 billion, and vehicles, $9.4 billion. Now, as we noted in the national interest, the basic structural political difference between the United States and China seem to make a trade conflict inevitable. China views commercial relations with other countries as an extension of the political conflict between Western democracies and itself. That is, an extension of war. Despite the rhetoric and hand-wringing from the American mainstream media, the prospect of cooler trade relations with China may provide the United States with an opportunity to expand ties with other Asian nations, such as Vietnam and India. If trade war with China becomes a permanent part of the American political landscape and the Trump tariffs remain in place, who loses? The direct losses will be borne by the importers, who will then pass those higher prices along to customers. As prices rise, the buyers will begin seeking substitutes. It should be apparent that a tariff is an aggressive tax and that increased taxes lower household income available for other expenditures. Whether Americans can find substitutes for Chinese goods, such as shoes, will determine the ultimate impact on prices and spending. U.S. retail sales unexpectedly fell in April as households cut back on purchases of motor vehicles and a range of other goods, pointing to a slowdown in economic growth after a temporary boost from exports and inventories in the first quarter, Reuters reports. This is an indication of the drag on growth that is caused by taxing things like imports. So in classic economic terms, the answer is a resounding yes. The surge in imports that was meant to avoid earlier tariffs now seem to have subsided. The only form of taxation that avoids the sales, reducing dynamic tariffs, is a properly adjusted progressive tax on each citizen's net income, notes author and attorney Fred Feldkamp. Each participant's marginal propensity to consume assures the capacity for continuous economic growth that is consistent with government fiscal responsibility. The United States even amended the Constitution in 1913 because only a tax on net income allows for truly fair taxation that does not restrain growth. So another aspect of the trade dispute is that the idea of a nuclear option, whereby China would sell its holdings of U.S. Treasury and agency securities to cause a collapse of the dollar. Economists and global pundits have spent weeks waxing effuse on the potential impact this would have on interest rates in the economy. Yet few serious analysts see a Chinese move out of the dollar for its official reserves as a practical possibility. So much more. But what I'm going to do, look, China is going to lose this. They've already lost the, they don't even know it yet. Which makes me, which kind of interests me. It's like, huh. But things might be a little tough. Just hang in there. It won't be tough forever. Of that, I can promise you. So let's see what else we've got. Should we talk about our friends, the social justice warriors, this week? All right, we've got a few minutes left here. Let's get on it. Now, should we do it? Yeah, we should do it. Let's do this. You guys love it. So do I. It's time, social justice. Let's see what they're up to this week. Hey, got a question for you people in Utah. Did you ever regret voting for Mitt Romney? Just a question between friends. There's a study. 75 American colleges offer black-only graduation ceremonies. I wonder if the National Association of Scholars... Well, let me ask you. What would they say if there were white-only graduation ceremonies? And guess what? There have been. A college admissions bribe scandal. The mastermind told white students to lie about their race. Oh, good Lord. What else have we got here? The hard-left labor leader backs British reparations for Africa and former colonies. Yeah, like they can afford that. California Governor Gavin Newsom, what a goof he is. He says, spare me your indignity about the unborn. A doctor could be fired for asking Muslim woman to remove her veil. Oh, what else we have? Transgender on gender swapping Snapchat filter. My gender is not a costume. Yep. Yeah, it's so true. It isn't. Oh, well. There's that, you know, I can't even get going to it. It just drives me bonkers. Anyways, look, we've had a lot to talk about today. And because we're limited on time, it is what it is. Hey, do me a favor. If you like what you hear, get hold of me. John Jeffers, my email is ContraRadioAtLive.com, ContraRadioAtLive.com, or get hold of KYAH 540 AM. Tell him you like the show. I appreciate it. If you like what you hear, $2. I'm asking for $2 a month. Give me a hand here, guys. Or if you're a business, give me a shout. We can talk very reasonable sponsorship. We really can. So I want you all to have a very safe Memorial Day. Remember those, the real reason why it is, why it exists. Until then, I'm John Jeffers, here on the Jeffers Brief, saying thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.